Welcome to the Earth Keepers Podcast. This podcast is for people who seek new and better ways to love and care for the Earth. It's a podcast for anyone who is deeply concerned about the harm being done to the environment on a local and global level. It's a podcast that builds community and connection between people of like heart and mind, people who believe that Earth care should be integrated into every aspect of life, and for many in the Earth Keepers community, that includes our spiritual lives. Welcome, friends, to the Earth Keepers Podcast. Hey, Earth Keepers. So I'm in the odd position of introducing an interview of myself. Recently, you see, Brandon Stiver and Phil Dark asked me to be a guest on their podcast called Think Global, Do Justice. Among other things, they wanted to ask me about a book I edited recently with Angel Burns called Reimagining Short-Term Missions. We also talked about many other interesting things like COP28, evangelical attitudes toward creation care, poverty and environmental justice, Star Trek, and even the story of how I came to adopt my daughter. So for a change of pace, here's an abridged version of Phil and Brandon's interview of yours truly.
Well, Forrest, it's so great to have you on Think Global. How you doing?
It's good to be in here. Thanks so much. Waiting for snow on my end, actually.
You know, where I'm at, we don't really get snow. Except one time in my town, a little fun fact, on one half of the town it snowed, on my half it did not snow. So that's pretty much where we're at in the Northern California area. Can you just introduce yourself to our audience?
Sure. Currently, I'm a part-time professor in international community development, live in the Seattle area. I also work for an organization called Circlewood, and for that organization, I focus on environmental education for churches and also do a podcast called Earth Keepers. Just in terms of how I got here, as a student in InterVarsity, really made a commitment to both community development and even missions. And so did lots of grad school and seminary prep for that, and eventually ended up in Istanbul, Turkey, living there for a while, doing theological education, working with street kids. And my primary job was helping to start a church with a group of new Christ followers there. Eventually came back to Seattle after a number of years there and started an MA program in community development in the area. And I guess I've had 17 years now of prepping students for nonprofit work all over the world. And it's really through them that I tend to have my nonprofit involvement. And it's really fun. I get to be in contact with folks doing cool work all over the world, like anti-trafficking, social enterprise, sustainable agriculture.
When we think about community development, or when we think about global development, one of the things that there's a lot of talk around and that you really have specialized in is issues around climate change, loss of biodiversity, pollution. We just recently had COP28, so these big meetings and talking through what agreements can we come to from an international multilateral standpoint. And for us as Christians, though, we have a higher mandate than just whatever international law or affairs says. But as we think about these things and based off of your work at Circlewood and elsewhere, could you maybe just give us a snapshot overview of what's happening? What on earth is happening? Literally, what on earth is happening? And to what degree should we be worried? Even what's the balance between doomsaying versus having Christian hope and action?
I won't say anything that people don't already know, but in brief, the climate is changing. And that means the world is changing, and it's rapidly becoming a planet that's getting harder and harder to live on. The weather's becoming more extreme. We're even now experiencing more severe weather-related disasters in the global north and global south. And whole ecosystems are collapsing. Whole species are disappearing. And in great part, it's the activities of people that are driving us toward global disaster. It's true, if we made necessary huge changes, the kind of changes discussed at COP28, especially eliminating our use of fossil fuel and switching to renewable power sources and more sustainable agriculture, we might, at the very least, reduce the severity of the changes that are already in progress. However, the changes we are making now are not nearly significant enough to make that much of a difference. Climate change is happening, and it's only going to get worse. But you asked about the balance between doomsaying on the one hand and Christian hope and action on the other. And really, that's the space between despair and hope that I do my most important work these days with Circlewood. Circlewood and the Earth Keepers podcast, we really are aiming to help Christ followers to face up to the truth of the unfolding climate disaster that we live in. At the same time, we're constantly working to remind Christians and ourselves that we follow a God who can do all things, a God of healing, even healing damaged ecosystems, a God of redemption and restoration, even able to redeem and restore blighted landscapes and environmentally impoverished communities. So basically, the way I think of it is we hold on to irrational hope, hope that's unwilling to give up on the suffering world because we understand that God loves this world still. So nothing's impossible, and I think it's incumbent on us as Christ followers to believe that, to hold on to hope, and to continue to not only have hope, but act on the hope. So in terms of action, just imagine if all God's people all over the world actually took seriously our God-given responsibility to take care of God's creation. What if churches everywhere became known for their passion for creation care? And what if Christ followers came to believe that acts of love and service and advocacy for creation were in some ways also acts of radical obedience and worship? That's the dream I have to hold on to, that I've devoted my life to. So basically, I choose to hope, and I try to encourage other people to have hope, as hard as that is in the light of circumstances that we face now.
That's so good. And of course, we can never divorce the reality of what's happening ecologically with the fact that humans have been given stewardship over this earth. That goes all the way back to Genesis 1. And one of the things that we've been talking about over the years has been poverty. And I really think there's a lot of interconnectedness between all of these different vulnerabilities, right? We talk about kids that are out on the streets. We talk about ecological degradation. We talk about poverty. We talk about other types of oppression and vulnerabilities in the world. There's a lot of interconnectedness between all of these things. Can you maybe help us draw that line between ecological degradation and poverty specifically?
Yeah, of course, that's becoming more and more of an issue these days as climate-related disasters are becoming more frequent. I think one thing that people are starting to come around to is the fact that poorer countries tend to suffer the effects of climate change to a much greater degree than folks in most wealthier countries, even though they have done very little to cause climate change. So there's a huge injustice that's sort of built into that dynamic. And that's why you often hear appeals like at COP28 for the transfer of wealth from rich countries, who are in great part responsible for climate change, to poorer countries to help them to mitigate the results of climate disasters like flooding and rising sea levels or devastating hurricanes. When these sorts of disasters hit people who are already poor, they only become poorer, and their chance of recovery, economically speaking, is diminished. Climate change is devastating whole economies and wiping out people's ability to care for themselves and their families. And already, we're seeing a demographic of what's being called climate refugees because people leaving their homelands because of climate disaster have made it impossible to stay where they are, to stay in life as they knew it. And so they're in desperation looking for a different context just in order to survive.
Why do you think it's important for Christians to not only think about their own family and community, which comes naturally when you're in your own backyard, but also consider the needs of people globally who we may never see, may never meet, ever?
Yeah, you know, I've actually weirdly thought about a version of that question recently, watching what's going on with Gaza, watching especially all the kids who are suffering because of that war. It's really made me ask, how long can we go on watching what's happening to people and guarding our hearts, walling off our hearts? If those were our own kids, we would be in despair. So I guess my answer that I'm coming to is I need to keep reminding myself that God loves all ethnic and nationalities just the same. Christ came into the world as an atoning sacrifice for all of us, and he taught us that we're to love our neighbors as ourselves. But I'm intrigued by the way you asked that question with that word families, because I think that for me has been a core issue in my life, is that whole journey to understanding what family really is. And I think one thing I've come to believe is that Jesus really redefines for us what family is. And in the New Testament especially, we see that family is no longer just about blood relation, but families expanded and redefined on new terms and new commitments. You know, in Turkey, blood is a really big deal. Blood connection is everything, and you're hugely, fiercely committed to your family, and much less so with people outside of that network. It was hard for Turks to understand the idea that God adopts us into the family of God, because adoption is not a done thing in Turkey. People just don't do it. And so you end up with a lot of street kids, for example. I would teach about adoption, and I thought I'm really teaching against resistance, but I realized at some point that people were really hearing me and taking me seriously, because one day they came to me and said, "Oh, we know what you think about adoption and how committed you are to it. So we have a child for you that you're going to adopt. And we know this woman who needs to find a home for her child who's not yet born. And we told her that you'd take the child." So I was a single guy still, and I was single then. But in that moment, I thought, no, this is it. This is what God has for you. So I said yes right away, and then freaked out later on. So a few months later, took the baby into my home on the day she was born, and was a single person I desperately needed. My family of the church. So they surrounded us, and to this day, I still call them family. And just last year, I was at a wedding of one of the little kids at the time and traveled out there for that. So the long answer to your question is, I think God redefines family, and sometimes we can focus too much on what's ours, what's around us, at the expense of having compassion for the needs around the world. I mean, can you imagine what it would mean if great sectors of the church began to advocate for that kind of justice, the justice of reparation and helping people to mitigate climate change? To me, that's work of grace and mercy, right? But it just sort of isn't on the church's radar that that could count as God's work, quote unquote. But I hope that that could change.
And I've even heard you say on your own podcast about this overemphasis among Christians or evangelicals that, of course, people matter most, but in some ways, people are the only ones that matter, meaning not necessarily creation or the environment of the earth. Where do you kind of see this pop up, and how is a better understanding of scripture help us to include other things in terms of what actually matters?
You know, that question really makes me think in broader terms beyond the evangelical church, because if you look at the field of economic development or community development, I think as a field, we have an overemphasis on the needs of people at the expense sometimes of the broader community of creation. It's understandable. What we're about is compassion. We want to save lives, make lives better. We want people to thrive. But I think that emphasis sometimes makes us short-sighted, and we don't think more holistically to understand that it's not just about people, that really it's our mission to look at the whole community of creation that includes the ecology, that includes the non-human elements of creation. So I think as a field, that corrective needs to happen, and I do see some movement to that end. It's one of the things I actually work for kind of through my students these days. But to your point about the evangelical church, they have similar, I would say, imbalanced priorities that I think we need to work on, partly because historically the emphasis has in evangelical circles been on the saving of souls. And the corollary assumption to that is often that the earth actually doesn't matter, because in the end, it's all going to burn anyway. What's really eternal is the souls of people. And I think that's just a historically entrenched misreading of scripture and ignores the principles that are spelled out in Genesis about our role to care for all of creation. I would say that I have to be careful about making sweeping generalizations, though, even about the evangelical church, because really much of the evangelical church does tend toward more of a balanced view of the environment. And I read a survey recently that 94% of British evangelicals think that it is a Christian's duty to care for the environment. That really surprised me. That seems really high to me. I think you see more divergence and division in the church in places like the US or Canada. I don't think that evangelical resistance to, say, believing in climate change has all that much to do with the Bible. I think really has more to do with politics and culture. In the States, for example, concern for the environment has really become culturally linked to liberal causes, quote unquote. And so environmentalism and environmental causes gets rejected out of hand by conservative elements of the church just because of labels, cultural associations. Similarly, a dominant element in American evangelical culture is a learned distrust of science, for example. So when scientists warn about impending changes that climate change is bringing and recommend to us lifestyle changes that we need to make to try to avoid those effects, the same sector of the evangelical church is culturally conditioned to close their ears to those voices, to view them as suspect. And these same sorts of biases also prevent them from paying any attention to the principles, again, of creation care that are throughout the Bible and especially are clarified in Genesis. Again, though, it's better not to generalize about evangelicals. I think that's even changing. I think that shift is happening. But there are plenty who do believe or could be persuaded to believe that God calls Christians to care for all of creation, including but not limited to people.
I appreciate what you said there, even in terms of people are maybe coming at this from different political standpoints, and they could be Christian or non-Christian, or there's going to be various people. You know, literally, as you were talking, there was a scene that popped into my head. I don't know if either of you are watchers of the show Parks and Rec, but there's a character on there, Ron Swanson, who's very libertarian, and he loves the outdoors. And there's another guy named Ron, who is his counterpart in another city. And he also loves the outdoors, and they think this is just the fantastic match between the two of them. But then he finds out that the other Ron is very tree hugger, liberal, whatever. And it's just funny because at first you think, oh, these two Rons have something to connect on, and yet they become diametrically opposed in other regards. It makes me think, man, whether you are of this political persuasion or that political persuasion, whether you are a Christian or a follower of another religion or no religion, it seems like hopefully we could all agree that the environment that we live in is important, and that hopefully, whether we're of this persuasion or that, that we would have that.
I appreciate your nuanced take on that, because I don't know if you've read Catherine Hayhoe's book. She does a great job of talking about how to talk about climate change issues. And she acknowledges that there are huge divisions, even within families, about how to view environmental issues. But her point is that you need to learn how to let go of some of the details, which may not be all that crucial, and just find those points of common ground. The two Rons, I think, is a great metaphor. They do, in fact, have a love of nature in common, and that is a basis for conversation, for moving ahead. I have a couple of students who live in the deep south of the U.S., and I had them on the podcast a couple of years ago, asking them, how do you do it? I know that you both are actually activists in terms of climate or earth advocacy, but how do you live in the South? And they talked about the need to really find those things in common. And they pointed out that a lot of folks in the South are hunters. And through hunting, they engage their environment and they love nature. So that becomes for them a place to start a conversation. And I just thought that was really profound and almost a corrective to me. I'd fall into the black and white thinking, like, oh, how could they be so stupid to believe this or that? And that just is not helpful to conversation. It gets us nowhere.
Totally. We always create these dichotomies that are really not serving anyone other than maybe trying to appease somebody's mental state. It's easy when you just think, well, I'm always right and those people are always not just wrong, but evil. But the reality is we have to live in multiple tensions just to really experience life as a human. And that doesn't only apply in this regard, but in many other areas of life as well. I'm just interested to hear from you, Dr. Inslee, as it does seem like a lot of the industrial and post-industrial technological practice got us into this problem that we're currently seeing. Is it realistic that we should actually then rely on technology to now get us out of it? Or was technology a part of the problem? How should we think through technology as it pertains to this conversation?
I don't have any proof for this, but anecdotally speaking, I think there's a generational difference in how to answer that question. Did either of you guys grow up on Star Trek?
Oh, yes, Next Generation with Picard. Yeah, so Data, Worf. I'm more of a Star Wars guy in general, but I don't know. How about you, Phil? Star Trek?
Nah, I typically am not a huge sci-fi, so I enjoyed Star Trek IV when they came to Earth. That was an interesting one for me. I know Star Trek well enough to probably get whatever you're throwing down here.
Well, Star Trek IV is a great example of what I'm talking about. It's the sort of magical thinking that we've learned, right? Technology can solve everything, and human beings are beautiful and are going to spread our beauty to the rest of the galaxy, right? But in Star Trek IV, in the future, humpback whales are extinct. So they go back in time to get humpback whales and bring them into the future. And everyone's like, yeah, a good job. But I think that we're just as naive sometimes in thinking that, technology is somehow going to solve the problem because it always does. But I think that magical thinking is not helpful at all. Sure, I get excited when I hear new technologies, like technologies that remove carbon from the air, and then you can either sequester it or reuse it. So I probably put too much hope in examples like that, because the fact is, it's not scalable. The world is not going to suddenly rally around some technology and pay for the technology and coordinate the technology. I mean, we can't even agree on fossil fuels. So I think it's an attractive but dead-end solution to think about technology solving our problems. Now, the fact is, technology has a lot to do with slowing the progress of global warming, because if we could only stop using fossil fuels and start using renewable sources like geothermal or solar or wind energy, we would do a lot to prevent the worst of climate change effects from coming to pass. But again, you don't see the widespread adoption of those technologies. And so, could it be a solution? Sure. But because human beings are in control of that tech, I don't think it's really reasonable to think about that.
Well, it kind of begs the question in some regards, because, well, what can we do? And especially with human society, really, the entire arc of history has been towards urbanization. That's kind of the major trend, and it continues to be the trend. So whether you're in the city or whether you're out maybe in the rural area, what should people do to play a role in terms of creation care, regardless of where you are, but especially for those city dwellers? What can people do? What should people do?
There's a book that I recommend to people by Norman Wurzbach called Agrarian Spirituality. And even though he's talking about a spirituality which finds its value home in farming and farmers and the way they think about nature, he translates that to urban dwellers and talks about how there are lots of ways to connect and reconnect to nature, but to do so with community. So whole communities, for example, might choose to farm together in an urban space and then to create food together and then create community around that food. So he has a lot of good ideas about how urban people can actually be an enormous part of helping us to think in different ways about our relationship to the earth. But I think in terms of the angle I'm interested in, I tend to think more about the causes of urbanization and migration to the cities. And in my view, from what I've learned, a lot of people end up in the cities because their more agrarian way of life is no longer possible. Modern industrial methods kick them out. It's not affordable. Big farms swallow up the land. Legal systems work against property ownership, so they can't actually lay claim to the land that they may have farmed for generations. So it's a lot of the reasons why people go to the city in the first place is just to survive. They can't survive closer to the land in the ways they've lived traditionally. So I would say that part of the problem when it comes to urbanization is that we need to focus on the source of the problem. Why are people flooding to the cities? And one thing that gives me hope is to look at organizations like Agros. We have a partnership, Circlewood does, with Camino Island Coffee, and Camino Island Coffee gives a lot of their profits to this organization called Agros. And I went with reps from the coffee company and with Agros to Nicaragua a while ago to see what they were doing with that money. And their approach to development is they focus on reestablishing ties to the land by creating new village cooperatives, often recruiting those same displaced farmers who were forced to go to the cities. So they have the skills, they just don't have the capacity. So they bring the farmers back to the land, establish them in a way that they have security to farm the land in perpetuity, and they do it together in a cooperative approach. And the villages focus on sustainable farming, caring for the environment, for example, growing shade-grown coffee as opposed to a more industrial approach to growing coffee beans. So there's a real sensibility of respect for the land that's built into the Agros model. And these communities are built on these ecologically sound and sustainable principles of reconnection to the land. And I think that's really an example of the direction I hope other development organizations might consider, is that more holistic thinking. But all to say that I think if you can prevent people flooding to the cities in the first place, that's part of the solution, I believe.
So you wrote a book or edited a book. I understand that editing process is a fun one and exhausting one as well. So kudos to you on that. But on a very important topic, especially we've talked a lot about on this podcast, but reimagining short-term missions is the name of that book. What compelled you to undertake that project? As somebody once told me about editing a book, especially with multi-authors, is it's like herding cats. So what compelled you to undertake that project, and why do you find it necessary for people to reimagine short-term missions?
Most of that, the motivation comes from experience, especially when I was living longer term in Turkey. I would see and sometimes have to host short-term teams. And it was sometimes very discouraging watching what people came to do, expecting to do, ways that they came thinking that they were experts with a gift to give to the people. And just, it was a naivety, which I found profoundly disturbing. But I don't know, have you guys been involved in short-term mission trips, leading or participating?
All of the above.
I wonder, have there been times when you've been in those situations and this little voice says, I'm not sure that this is what Paul meant, right? When he talks about the things he did on his missionary journey. Does that resonate with you?
Oh, for sure.
I think that that's actually the experience of most people who've been involved in short-term missions. On the one hand, they've got the best motives possible, right? It's biblical. Go and spread the gospel, make disciples of all nations. So who can fault that? But I think what has happened is that short-term missions has really become an industry in the last few decades. And we maybe have lost our way in terms of why we do it and what we do. And so really the book was in response to those questions that I think people are already asking, those suspicions that maybe we're not getting it right. Maybe there's a better way to use our time and resources. So we really set out to do this anthology of essays with two goals. The first goal was to, first of all, pay attention to voices outside of the Western church sphere. One of our main points in the book is that in terms of mission, we need to think in terms of the global church and to stop thinking of sender and receiver, right? That really the church is all over the world. So we need to work together. And those of us in the West who want to do something in terms of missions in, say, the global South, we need to trust ourselves to the people in the global South to know better how to use us as a resource. Maybe even to the point of saying, we don't think you should come at all. But that just takes real humility, and it's not a Western mindset to think in those more collaborative terms. And so the other main theme of the book is a word that we ended up making up. And that word is co-powerment. And that word stands against empowerment, which is a limited word. Empowerment is useful at times. It implies that there's someone who has power or resources and they're giving it to someone else. And so aid agencies, mission agencies speak in terms of empowerment, as well they should. But the point we're making in the book is that sometimes we shouldn't think in those terms. Sometimes we shouldn't assume that we have the upper hand, that because we have the resources that we can call the shots and pretend that we're experts. So co-powerment is more of an interactive dynamic that I need you to make me possible as much as you need me to make you possible, right? So if I feel like I really want to obey the Bible and get involved in missions, I shouldn't be the one to determine exactly what that looks like. I should actually ask others in the global church, what can this look like in ways that are collaborative, that draw on context knowledge that you have that I simply don't. So I think that's really the point of the book. And it's the reason we try to include a lot of voices from all around the world is because it represents that co-powering dynamic that we're trying to promote.
I love that. The book that I wrote was similarly, it was 15 co-authors, people who have worked in different places around the world, brought in some people from around the world, and it was so powerful. But that idea of doing that is so good because even if it's similar backgrounds, it's just, it's something that brings in such different voices from different places and for people to learn from each other as well. And being able to edit that, I no doubt you were challenged and you were encouraged and you were emboldened, hopefully, to really have clarity on different things, which is awesome. So thanks for doing that. That's fantastic. So we always like to have part of this conversation be, what's a promising practice? What is something good going on? What do you see that's encouraging you about what's going on with short-term missions currently?
Well, I would say that to your point about my being affected by the work I was editing, it really was encouraging to hear the stories of people who are in the quote-unquote mission field, who are doing things differently, finding ways forward that are more collaborative, are based more on mutual humility and mutual collaboration. So I think in the book, there are lots and lots of encouraging stories, but maybe the one I'm closest to, just to give you an example, is my own church here in Seattle, which is Bethany Community Church. We've historically built any missions involvement on partnership, long-term partnership. So for example, we have partnership with churches and nonprofits in Rwanda. And in those relationships, we as a church submit ourselves to their guidance in what our involvement looks like. And even if we're offering them resources, we're never offering resources on the condition of this is what you must do with this, right? But we ask the folks there, how can this make the biggest impact? How can this help us to be obedient to the Great Commission? And so I think that relationship has really shaped even short-term missions, because the people who go to Rwanda are really going more for reasons of education and learning and partnership, building those relationships. More recently, I think we've built enough trust as a church that the Rwandan folks have asked us to help them teach things that we might know, say certain kinds of leadership approaches, et cetera, or nonprofit management, what have you. And that kind of trust only comes over time, and it only comes in a relationship where you're acknowledging that both sides have something to offer. Both sides are equally valuable in the equation. I'm most excited by maybe what's happened most recently in that same relationship. We've begun to practice reverse missions. So we have Rwandans coming to us and consulting with us. And for example, our church has a ministry to folks who are homeless or involved in the sex trade, et cetera. And we have asked the Rwandan folks to speak into our ministries, to evaluate them and give us feedback from outside of the Western perspective. And so we get wisdom that we just would not otherwise get. And I just think that I laud the humility of the leaders in our church to be that open, because that's risky, right? And it wars against the mentality that we're taught in the Western world, that it's the expert who holds the power. And so we need to know what we're doing and we need to lead. But oftentimes that translates into hubris, obviously.
Forrest, I would love, just as we wrap up our time, we have an audience that is passionate about God, passionate about setting things right in the world, seeing communities develop, progress, and so forth. Would love if you could just quickly give us your best piece of advice for someone that is pursuing God's heart of justice in the nations. What would be one thing that you would recommend that they do? Something practical, something they can jump into?
Well, I love it that we're ending a conversation on themes of humility and listening and teachability, because I really think that that is the key. When you say justice, I would say that we as Western Christ followers need to, first of all, learn that justice can be defined both in terms of environmental justice and social justice, and that the two are really interconnected. So I would say, first of all, define justice for what it really could be, just more broadly and holistically. Don't assume that you know what justice or injustice looks like. And I would say part of that is confessing to God at the outset that, like all human beings, we see the world through cultural biases, and we have to ask God to help us to see more clearly. And then in true humility, take the time to listen and to learn from those who live in the context of injustice, and let them and the Holy Spirit guide us in how to pursue justice.
Dr. Inslee, thank you so much for that. Justice is something that's so dear to the heart of this podcast community, and I just appreciate that reflection. So Forrest, thank you so much for joining us. I really have appreciated our time.
Thank you. It's been an honor.
You've been listening to an interview of me, Forrest Inslee, on the podcast called Think Global, Do Justice. For more information on some of the topics we covered in this conversation, check out the show notes for this episode at earthkeepers.online. The Youth Keepers podcast is an expression of Circlewood, an organization committed to cultivating a more ecologically conscious faith. For more information about the podcast or to learn about the ways you can support this work, go to our website at earthkeepers.online. You can contact us by leaving a voicemail through the podcast website or by emailing us at earthkeepers@circlewood.online. I am Forrest Inslee, your podcast host. James Amidon is our executive producer. Our content editor and researcher is Colleen Meggerly, and our sound engineer is Dave Wolfers. Jesselyn Gentry is our social media director, and Forrest Reed is the composer of our original music. Thank you for listening, friends, and please join us for our next conversation on the Earthkeepers podcast.